Good afternoon, Tufts listeners. WMFO Medford, thank you for listening. Chuck Morse, conducting my biannual program here. Welcome aboard. You're welcome to join us at 855-915-WMFO. 855-915-9636. That's okay. I'll be okay. That's 855-915-9636 here at WMFO 91.5 AM, Medford, Boston, serving the Tufts University community. It's a pleasure. It's an honor. As I continue my sort of hopefully friendly crusade, my informal crusade to poke a little needle into the political correct college culture, the program is every other week, as I mentioned, at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Thursdays. I'm told that the show will expand to a weekly, possibly even a daily, this summer. And at that point, I'll be prepared to do that. And also at that time, I hope to contact other college stations through the Spinitron system to see about going live. I've invited guests today from Tufts University. They have not responded to me. They just didn't feel, apparently, that they needed to even contact me to say that they would not be making it. And they were from a group called Tufts United for Immigration Reform. Let me just see here the exact title. Getting a little flustered with the fingers. Tufts United for Immigrant Justice. Now, I happen to notice, and I've been at this for a while, I've been doing radio now off and on for the past 10 years, that when I started doing radio, I would often have people up to the program who were liberals, who were left. I mean, I tend to have forged a reputation for being a conservative. And there would be a great, vigorous dialogue, a friendly dialogue. There'd be an amazing exchange of ideas and opinions. And I think that I've noticed, and this could be me, maybe people, whatever, you know, who knows. This could be strictly anecdotal. Yeah, I'm fixing my hairpiece here. but I've noticed that people are not coming anymore. They're not joining me anymore. And even to the point where they don't even bother to respond anymore. And I think that that might be, I hope it's not, I actually would be more comfortable knowing that maybe people have something against me, even though they probably don't even know who I am, which is fine. But I suspect that it might be something more systemic than that. There's a breakdown in civil discourse. There's a kind of a circling the wagons. Maybe it's happening on the conservative side too, no doubt. That people aren't talking to each other anymore. Everyone's gone off to their own little corners. Maybe it's the advent of the internet. You know, there used to be more of a, maybe I'm aging myself here, but back in the day, there was more of a social feel to things. People would go out to clubs. People would, you know, I remember Inman Square back in the 1970s. The place was packed on the street. People would be overflowing outside the Inn Square men's bar and other clubs. Paul's Mall Jazz Workshop, you know, these great bars and these great musical venues. And people would go over to friends' house and they would hang around and socialize more. I think that now, maybe it's because of the internet, people tend to, you know, they Facebook each other, but they sit there and they with their screen and they're sort of more isolated, and I'm no different. I'm doing the same. And I wonder what the long-term social ramifications of that are. But either way, Tufts United for Immigrant Justice has not contacted me. They have a bill, I guess you might say, or a petition to make Tufts University a sanctuary college. And that would include students and anyone in the community who is an illegal alien to come to Tufts. And this is the awareness of it has been heightened since the election of Donald Trump because of a lot of stuff that a lot of fear that Donald Trump is going to enforce the laws and expel people who are here illegally. And so there's a major movement afoot with regard to protecting people who are not here legally. I would rather see a focus on a path to citizenship, quite honestly, an attempt to help people who are justly qualified to immigrate to the United States and to receive citizenship, rather than, you know, I mean, look, I think that there are a lot of people, especially the Dreamers, and on this one I agreed with President Obama, that, you know, when you have people who came here as young children and who have spent their entire life here, they've gone to high school, they want to be in college, they are in college, but their parents were not legal citizens. What's going to happen? Are they going to be expelled from the country? That's not practical. I also don't think it's practical to expel millions of people. I just don't think it's a good idea economically, let alone morally. You know, we depend upon illegal aliens to do a lot of, I mean, George Bush was right about that, to conduct a lot of the work that Americans don't want to do. And if they're here working and they're able-bodied and they're functioning citizens and they want to become citizens of the United States, I do think that it's appropriate to have a screening process by which they can have a background check, they can be vetted properly, perhaps it could be some education around what it means to be an American citizen. You know, a little bit about the Constitution of the United States and all of the rest, and they can learn about the value of American citizenship. And then there should be a loyalty oath, which is a pledge of allegiance and essentially a swearing-in oath, so that we have some assurance as American citizens that the person becoming a new citizen is not going to be a criminal, and is not going to be a subversive. They're not here to try to overthrow the government. They're not here to try to import the means of government that they left behind. And I think that as citizens, we have a right to expect that. Now, once they're citizens, once they're sworn in, once they've become citizens, I mean, I suppose that I don't want to remove someone's citizenship if they become involved in a subversive organization, whether it be, you know, whether they become a communist or a white supremacist or something else that, of course, would be anathema to our way of life. That's freedom. They are a citizen. But I think that we should expect that at least we have a running chance that people who come here are people who like us and who want to honor and protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, not replace it with some other form of government, whether it be a communist form or Sharia law or white supremacy, whatever. But I think that to suggest that we put the cart before the horse and we give rights to people who are presently not citizens, it undercuts people who are citizens. To provide public assistance to people who are not citizens, or to provide it to people who are coming across the border, which is something that the National Lawyers Guild advocates, and that's a communist group. I don't think there's anything that they wouldn't deny that. Is something that puts the American citizen in jeopardy, because we're taxpayers. They're asking us to take money out of our pockets, money that would go to our families, money that we earned, and give it to them simply because they want it. There's no moral justification for that. You know, it's one thing if someone is a fellow citizen and they've been paying into the system, They have Social Security, and they need assistance temporarily. That's one thing. But to have someone come into this country from overseas, and without becoming a part of the productive sector, without producing, without earning, without working, but immediately getting a check from us, I think that's wrong. I also think that there's a danger in the fact that people who are here who are not vetted, and that's basically, frankly, what President-elect Donald Trump is talking about. That's what he talked about in his announcement for the presidency, that people are coming into this country who are not vetted, who are not wishing us well, and that includes drug dealers, and it includes rapists, and it includes terrorists, possibly. I mean, the FBI has said that there are terror cells around the country right now, and they are people who are not, in many cases, citizens, who are recruiting citizens to become a part of their movement. We don't have to put up with that. And I think that's really what President-elect Trump is talking about. I don't think he's talking about expelling millions of people who are here and who are, as he described them, good people who are trying to earn a buck, who are trying to integrate themselves into the American dream. I don't blame them at all. You know, they're leaving these miserable hellholes to come here. But if they're trying to import the miserable hellhole to here by advocating for the socialistic system that they fled, that I have a problem with. Anyway, you're welcome to join me. By the way, I'm also live on YouTube today as I launch the YouTube part of the program. I want to see how that does. You know, I mean, I've seen some of these YouTube stars come up, and my daughter actually kind of brought me into that, and it's an interesting venue. So, you know, this is King of All Media. I'm live at Tufts. I'm on YouTube. The program later today will be podcasted on iTunes. The audio will be. Maybe I could even podcast the video. I don't know. Once I find out about something, I tend to run with it. So we shall see. Well, yesterday, let me give out the number. You're welcome to join me. Let me look up here. I know this looks kind of silly. 855-915-WMFO, 855-915-9636. Hopefully I can know how to pick up the phone. What is on your mind this afternoon, eh? All right. Yesterday morning, I woke up to look at the Drudge Report, which I often do. And on that report, I saw an article by CNN, which is a trusted news organization, that said that the CIA, in their private meeting with President-elect Donald Trump the past Friday, had handed him a two-page memo that indicated that the Russians had hacked not just the Democratic National Committee, but also his organization, and that they had damaging information about him. It said it was both personal information and also some of his business dealings. And that he was susceptible to blackmail as a result of that. And I looked at that thing and I'm like, oh no, you know, President-elect Trump is in trouble. That's not good. We can't have the Russians blackmailing. You know, blackmail is an old tactic that goes way back. The classic cliche is that the politician, in fact, they did this in the Godfather movie. It's kind of funny. But the politician that is to be targeted for blackmail, you know, they get him drunk, they put him in bed with a hooker, take pictures, and then he gets called in the office. Lyndon Johnson used to do this, right? He'd have FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover come into the office, drop a manila envelope on the table, and out would fall salacious pictures of the politician in bed with a hooker. And he'd be like, well, now, do you really want to have this go out into the media? Do you really want to see your wife and children get a look at this? And before you know it, he's got the guy like putty in his hands. Well, that is exactly the allegations that came out about Trump, according to this story in CNN. In fact, it was worse. There's really like disgusting details. Again, the American people had to hear about perverted, personal, ugly, you know, nasty sort of sexual stuff. It reminded me almost of like the Monica Lewinsky time when we would have to report on the, if you don't mind my using a pun, the blow-by-blow details of Bill Clinton's nefarious activities in the Oval Office with Monica Lewinsky. I mean, the whole country, everyone, children, they all, parents had to explain to their children watching the 6 o'clock news what was going on. It really brought down the whole tenor of the country. It kind of like shrunk our entire, you know, moral fabric right into the gutter. And that's exactly what's happening here with these allegations about Trump. Now, Donald Trump did a press conference yesterday at noon, and he stated unequivocally and uncategorically that this was completely false and that this is utter garbage. And he named specifics to back that up, as did his press secretary, Sean Spicer, and others. And by the end of the day, it appeared that the whole story had fallen apart, that it was false. At least that's how it appeared. And that even the New York Times, which is very anti-Trump, they would not carry the story because it didn't look right to them. But CNN had carried it, and they now look terrible. You know, they're carrying what's called fake news. You know, they didn't vet it properly, and you know, I wouldn't have believed it if I saw it on some, you know, either left-wing or right-wing media outlet. But because I saw it on CNN, which is a respectable mainstream news venue, I believed it. And now they've got caught with egg in their face, and it turns out that it's false. However, in the meantime, Trump had to answer to this just 5 days or 7 or 8 days before taking office. It was a big distraction. It was a blast over his bow. It was damaging. You know, as I think it was Mark Twain who said that a lie has flown halfway across the world before the truth even has a chance to put its pants on. And thus, by the end of the day, the whole brouhaha had settled down. But it was damaging. And I think that it's safe to say that the people who want to get Trump, or at least rough him up and damage him, are not only willing to resort to just about anything short of a bullet, and God willing, they don't go that far, but the powers against him are so fierce and are so determined that I'm just amazed that the man is still standing and that he is still proceeding forward. I mean, Donald Trump is a force of nature. Whether you like him or not, I would suggest you may disagree with him on specific issues and stands. I probably do too. But the man he's got cojones. I mean, he is standing up there in the breach. He's calling out the CIA, the FBI, all these groups that I would, you know, conventionally think the left would hate and have been trying to reform and have attacked for decades. And he's saying that they were involved in this misinformation. Now, they deny that. But the very fact that he would take them on is an incredible development. And by the way, right here at Tufts University, we have at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, Michael Glennon, professor, former counsel to the U.S. Senate, brilliant guy. I interviewed him on my radio show about a year ago. He wrote a book called The Double Government, where he talks about how this national security infrastructure has become so massive and so powerful, starting in the late 1940s when it was established by President Harry Truman, it was the CIA, the NSA, and the National Security Council, NSC. Since then, it has grown into millions of employees, trillions of dollars, who knows how much money, and off the record, off the book monies, an international octopus, with the spying. I mean, we saw what the revelations by Edward Snowden of how extensive their spying capability is. And that the last president to, frankly, honestly take them on in any significant way was the late President John F. Kennedy, okay? I think we know what happened. It wasn't good. Anyway, let me briefly grab the notebook here. I'll do a public service announcement. You're listening to WMFO AM 91.5, and you're welcome to join us. 855-915-9636. I'll be right back. And, look, I do this the old-fashioned way. When it comes to technical stuff, it ain't my specialty. It ain't my business. Numbers to think about. Prescription drug versus medical marijuana deaths. This is an important one, actually. Number of Americans that die each day from an accidental overdose of prescription drugs, 54. Number of human beings that have died from an overdose of medical marijuana in all recorded history, 0. This is a message in the public interest from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. Let me comment briefly here. I agree with them about the prescription drugs. I'm not sure I agree with them about I agree with them about medical marijuana, yes, but recreational, not so fast. I think that prescription drugs, since we're on the topic, are overprescribed. There are dangerous side effects to them. I would point out that most of these mass murders over the past 20, 25 years, going back to Columbine, have involved young people on psychological drugs. Okay. Now, I'm not saying that they don't have a purpose. I think that it's dangerous when you're dealing with younger people, however. Just like alcohol is more dangerous when you're a younger person. If you're under maybe 21, 20, 19, your body is not yet developed fully. You may feel like you're developed fully, but you're not. And you're not set up to handle controlled substances, whether it be alcohol or drugs, in the same way that someone who is my age is able to. I mean, when you reach your 40s, 50s, you can have a drink or even take a drug, and, it doesn't have the same effect on you, physically, let alone emotionally, psychologically. I generally would think that there ought to be some real caution. Just like for the example, it's not legal for young people to drink until you reach the legal age. I would think that there ought to be extreme caution with regard to prescribing these controlled substances. And I would mention that anyone who is taking controlled substances, I'm not suggesting you don't take them. That's not my business, nor would I even think of suggesting such a thing at all. However, I would simply suggest that you read the label and you read the, whoops, what's going on here? You read the I guess that the, my YouTube thing has run out, which is probably just as well because you don't want to ramble on too much with YouTube. But I would suggest you read the label, essentially. There are side effects. There are consequences of all of these, virtually all of these drugs. It's very rare that that any of these... let me just see if that was saved. I hope it was. Let's see. Wait a minute. Yeah, I'm just... okay, no. All right, let's see. Oh, boy, I don't know if it was. Well, if it wasn't, then it wasn't. What can you do? We're still up here on WMFO AM 91.5, Tufts Live. I'm learning this technology. I mean, it's all new to me still, so I don't know. Let's see. Well, I could do it this way, I suppose. There we go. Anyways, there we go. It's all still new to me, the technology here. But I guess that I might want to consider putting it, shutting it down after a few minutes and then starting again. That's how you learn this business, you know. I mean, I'm doing this thing new. So the first half hour, we talked about the group trying to make Tufts University a sanctuary city for illegal aliens. My feeling on that is mixed in that I support the road to citizenship, particularly for young people whose parents came here and they grew up here. They went to high school here. They went to college here. There ought to be a road to citizenship for them. I agreed with President Obama's executive order on that, and I hope that President Trump is able to make it legal by suggesting it to by filing a bill with Congress, letting Congress have an up and down vote on it, and making that the law. I also do not think it's realistic to deport millions of people. We need them. They add to the economy. The economy would collapse without them. However, we need to vet them. We need to know who they are. We need to make sure that they are not criminals or terrorists or rapists, as Trump so indelicately put, and that they're here as able-bodied citizens, willing to work. They're not on welfare, that they are here to contribute to American life, and that they take a loyalty oath as they enter in. They take an oath to the Constitution. You know, I think that that's a reasonable thing to expect. Some of these groups that are supportive of Sanctuary City, they seem to have a bigger agenda, quite frankly, in that it's not so much that they want to give sanctuary to illegal aliens. And by the way, I mean, I suppose having said that, why aren't they supportive of building the wall? You know, I mean, why not secure the borders so that we can then not only create a pathway to citizenship for people who are here illegally and make sure that they undergo the proper vetting, but that we can then have an ability as a nation to decide who comes in and who doesn't. Isn't that a basic function of any sovereign nation? I think so. Just like it's your right as a citizen, as a person, to decide who goes into your home and who doesn't. The nation state has a right to decide who enters the national home and who doesn't. And we elect governments to regulate that policy. We may want to be liberal about it, have more immigration, or conservative. It depends on a lot of factors. It depends on the economy. It depends on the culture. It depends. It doesn't matter really ultimately what the reasons are. The fact is that we, as a sovereign nation, have a right to make the decision. Just like any sovereign nation has the right. If we were in Zimbabwe, we would have the right to decide who comes in and who doesn't. That is one of the functions of national sovereignty. And I think that what I detect in certain of these organizations who are advocates for what they call euphemistically migration or immigration, when in fact it's illegal aliens, is that they do not value sovereignty as a concept, let alone American sovereignty. They believe literally in open borders. I mean, I suppose if you got down to like asking them, well, if you believe in open borders, would you mind having 100 million Muslims come into the country? I mean, I guess that might call the bluff, and maybe they wouldn't care. I don't know. The point is that philosophically, they don't believe in borders. They don't believe in property. They don't believe in your right to own that which you own. They don't believe in private ownership. They don't believe in the private ownership of the means of production. Let's call it what it is. They're communists. They think there's a virtue in abolishing private ownership, that this is good, right? That this is an ultimate goal. They have a utopian idea that this is some kind of an ideal, as if doing something like that is going to help anybody, rather than be very, very destructive and very damaging to everybody. So I think that in a discussion about this, while we can have a legitimate conversation about offering citizenship to young people who grew up in this country and who have gone to high school here and they're in college here, to get them citizenship. They should have citizenship, right? They didn't do anything. They were too young to know any better when their parents broke the law by crossing the border. I don't want to blame them. And they're contributing to the country. I want to help them. I think we all do. We need them. And also people who are here working, who are here contributing. I actually think that getting them into citizenship is a more humane approach because they're being exploited by corporations who have them in there. We don't know what kind of labor conditions, right? You know, so we value labor in this country. We value standards of labor. And in that capacity, we should invite them and give them a pathway to citizenship. There ought to be a period of education about the Constitution. We ought to make sure that they understand a little bit about American history and about American ideas and philosophy. And then they ought to take an oath of office, if you will, a loyalty oath, where we can ask them to, or we can expect them to be loyal to the Constitution and not loyal to some foreign means of government, whether it be communist or Sharia law or white supremacy or anything else. You know, these things obviously are anathema to America's ethos, American way of life. We want to know that they want to be here because we're American and they want to be Americans. We want to know that, right? I mean, that's how my grandparents and great-grandparents did it. They weren't given welfare. They weren't given anything. They came here because they wanted to be free. And they worked very hard to Americanize, to assimilate, to acculturate. Didn't mean they lost their religion. They didn't. Or their previous culture, which they also held on to a certain extent, but only as a subculture to the bigger culture which they loved, and that was the American culture. And in fact, this is an issue that was addressed by George Washington in his farewell address, where he said that while he wants to preserve the right of all Americans to, and I can't quote it, but I read it, to continue their unique and particular manners and ethnicities and beliefs, at the same time, his hope was that all Americans would embrace America first, a united culture, a united language, a united people, a United States. And that's a principle that I support. And I think that we ought to expect as a bare minimum our new immigrants' support. So having said that, I think that we need to examine and debate, frankly, other agendas that might be attached to what looks like on the surface to be a humane idea. And by doing so, we might stand to actually get to a genuinely progressive approach, as opposed to a loaded approach. So, in that capacity, I contacted this group to join me today here at Tufts University, where I am presently broadcasting, and do so every Thursday, every other Thursday right now. And they didn't get back to me. And as I mentioned in the first segment, this has become common. I don't think it's unique to me personally. I think it has more to do with the fact that unlike years ago when I started in this business, when I would always have people up from all sides of a view, people from the left, right, and center, they'd come in. We wouldn't agree. We'd sometimes have heated discussions, but it was always friendly. It was always respectful. Now they don't even contact me anymore. They don't want to come on. Nobody wants to talk about differences. It's not even that they say no. They just don't bother to get back to me at all. And I wonder if it's because of me, but I think it probably isn't. I think it's probably because the people aren't talking to each other anymore. People are all polarized. Look at this election. I mean, the bitterness of people who over Trump's election is inexplicable to me. In fact, you can text me if you want on YouTube or call me to talk about that. But I can tell you that I attended several social events after the election, one of which was Thanksgiving with friends of my family's. And I was told in advance this would be a Trump-free zone. We're not going to talk about Trump. And they were too upset to even mention the name. What the heck is that about? We should be celebrating. Even look at, I didn't vote for Barack Obama. And I didn't admire him or his policies. But I celebrated when he won because I was happy and relieved and pleased that this nation had a peaceful revolution, a peaceful transfer of power. And I respected that, and I gave him a honeymoon. I didn't attack. You know, it's like, you know, you give somebody a chance to kind of get their feet wet, and then you disagree based upon issues. You know, you go into what might euphemistically be called the loyal opposition. Okay.
Anyway, here we go. It's all still new to me. The technology.
I'm going to shut it down because I don't want to lose it, you know. Okay, let's see. So I'm experimenting today with YouTube, basically. Let's go with Beam or 8mm. Looks good. No, I don't like that. That's too dark. Normal. I'll go with normal. Okay. And anyway, so you're listening to WMFO. So I'm looking at this page here, published by Tufts Disorientation.org, and it's called the Tufts Disorientation Guide. They have a list of clubs and spaces. I suppose spaces implies safe spaces. Alternative Jewish communities at Tufts, Alt-J. Let me just talk a little bit. I mean, they're all left-wing groups, in which, of course, they have a right to be, but I'd like to interview each of them. Alternative Jewish communities at Tufts. It says, if you were Jewish and an incoming freshman at Tufts, you have most likely received an email or postcard heralding Tufts Hillel as a thriving Jewish community center for students. The advertisements you've been sent show pictures of smiling students celebrating a shared history and set of traditions, and you might have considered dropping by to see what this community is all about. If you are Jewish and a first year at Tufts, you may or may not have the critical opinion of institutions like Hillel International that take an overtly nationalist and Zionist stance toward Israel. You may or may not want to affiliate yourself with an institution that refuses to partner with, house, or host organizations, groups, or speakers that deny Israel the right to exist with its current organized, recognized borders. Delegitimate, demonize, or apply a double standard to Israel. Support boycott of divestment from and sanctions against the state of Israel. Now, this group here is basically saying that, well, you know, they are accurately identifying Hillel as pro-Israel. That's for sure. Pro-Zionist. Zionism is just Israel. It's a national movement of the state of Israel, just like being a patriot means you're pro-American. Nothing more and nothing less, I'll point out. There's certainly a lot of anti-Semites who have weird conspiracy theories about that. But I guess my position is that this group wants to push Hillel into recognizing their group, which is anti-Israel, frankly. I don't care what they say. It just is. Anyone who's gone to their groups knows this. As a group on the far left, they're anti-national. They don't like any nation state. You know, they tend to believe in one world collective futures or utopias. So it's not even just Israel that they're singling out, although in this case, they are. And my response to that is that they have a right to their opinions. They have a right to their organization. Why do they have to impinge it upon the Hillel? Just for the same reason that they have a right to be anti-Israel, Hillel has a right to be pro-Israel. Just like they can be anti-Zionist, Israel can be pro-Zionist. Just like they're anti-national, Israel, Hillel can be pro-national. You know, we don't all have to agree, nor is there any reason rationally why we should all agree, because we're not going to agree. We're human beings. We come from things at different places. I think that the proper answer to this is to let each group have its own space, if you will. I know they're using that word now. And let people decide and let there be a debate. You know, this is what I'm decrying about the fact that people... Here I am at Tufts University launching a program that looks at college culture, tries to bring up alternative opinions and thoughts. And I would expect in an institution, especially like Tufts, which is one of America's preeminent institutions of learning and intellectual power, that they would be embraced. People would say, great. Let's bring it on. Let's have the conversation. But that's not how they do it now. Instead, they'll try to shut you down. They'll try to shut you out. In the case of Hillel, they're trying to subvert Hillel by going in and saying, you know, it'd be like, I don't know, the National Organization of Women having to accept, you know, pro-life women, right? You know, they advocate abortion on demand. That's their right. That's their position. Should they have to take on women who want to ban abortion? Should they have to take on men? Why should women have a group? You know, isn't that discriminating? You know, in other words, there is plenty of room for people who take all sorts of positions for all sorts of reasons. And you may not like it, but that's... I mean, isn't that why we have... not to mention a free society, but an institution of higher learning so that we can examine and debate and have discourse over these things. Anyway, I would like to have this group come up here. I haven't invited them yet. I probably will, and I doubt if they'll even kind of come back to me, but alternative Jewish communities at Tufts. And ask them exactly what the deal is with their opposition to Israel as a sovereign state, and try to find out if it's because specifically of Israel that they don't like as a sovereign state, or are they against the whole concept of sovereign statehood. I would expect that it's the other. Anyway, there's a lot of, the Association of Multiracial People, Black Student Union, Loving Ourselves as Queer Students of Color, Pan-African Alliance. Talk about national. Aren't they kind of nationalistic in terms of black nationalism? Prison Divestment Coalition. Students Against Mass Incarceration. Interesting. I guess that in the coming weeks and months, as I roll out this program, I'll have to delve into all of these and try to see about having them all up. You know, I'll send them all a note. We'll see what happens. Anyway, let me go here and do another public service announcement. Let's see here. Big Brothers and Big Sisters. This is something I'm actually thinking of getting involved in myself. Be a Big Brother, Big Sister volunteer and rediscover the kid in you. Being a big means simply sharing a little time with one great kid, just like someone once did for you. They match your hobbies, geography, interests, and personality with those of a little brother or little sister, ages 7 to 14. You can enjoy free tickets to pro sports, play ball, talk, or just hang out. You decide. You also get to be a kid again for a few hours a month. To learn more, please call 888-412-BIGS. That's, I'm sorry, 888-412-BIGS. Or visit us online at bigbrothersbigsisters.org. Very good group. Very good group from what I've heard. Don't drink and drive. On February 9th, 2014, a drunk driver headed the wrong way down a Southern California freeway, crashed and killed 6 people, including her own sister. If you're under the influence of anything, never even think about getting behind the wheel of a car and driving. People die that way. This is a public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. I should mention that my books are available at Amazon, Amazon Kindle. Just go there, put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, Morse like Morse code. And you shall see those books come up. They're moderately priced. They've got interesting covers. These are full-length books. Many of them are up to 70,000 words. They deal with a cross range of topics, whether it's economy, politics, culture, health, philosophy, religion, law. I tend to cover the mat. So check them out. They're at Amazon Kindle. Just put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, and up they come. And my column. My column is weekly now. It's up usually on Mondays or Tuesdays at Newsmax.com. It's kind of an interesting nonpartisan site. My column actually appears near that of Robert B. Reich. I mean, it's kind of a both liberals, conservatives, moderates. It leans conservative, but they carry everybody, it seems. My latest article, which I'm just working on today, I'll read a little of it. It's called Why Hillary Lost. Hillary Clinton lost because she became so confident that she would win that she and the Democrats forgot to stuff the ballot box. Am I being provocative here? Perhaps Hillary didn't get the memo from campaign manager John Podesta about the rigged polls that had her up by 8 to 10%. The famous hack of Podesta's email indicates that he was in communication with major pollsters regarding the creation of creating a sense of inevitability by polling largely Democratic voters. While the Republicans are not above voter fraud in certain exceptional situations, the Democrats have a long and storied history of stealing elections, going back recently to the actions of Acorn, which served as the Democratic Party shock troops starting in the 1970s. Let me just get rid of the word recently. It's redundant. Employing the technique patented by Professors Richard Cloud and Francis Fox Piven to overwhelm the system until things break down and authoritarian socialism is able to march in on a white horse, Acorn started to flood the voter rolls in cities with false registrations in elections going back to the 1980s. Now, Richard Cloud and Francis Fox Piven were professors at Columbia University. They were married. They were sociologists, very left-wing. They published a private paper in, I think it was 1968, 1969, one that was eventually turned into an article that was published in Nation magazine, where they opined that the way to implement socialism in America was to overwhelm the bureaucracy, overwhelm the system, jam it up. It's like jamming up a toilet till it overflows. And thus, once things get so short-circuited, the socialists can march in on a white horse and save the day. And the way they first started doing this, through groups like Acorn, groups that were set up once Richard Nixon became president, by the way. Nixon switching the emphasis from the Johnson approach of the big society and the war on poverty, where these huge federal agencies would spread around, you know, billions of dollars to people. He instead would give block grants to groups who would do the same thing, and even worse. And that's why you had groups like Acorn set up, in that case in Little Rock, Arkansas, to handle left-wing advocacy and community activism. Yeah, this is where Saul Alinsky got his start in Chicago. He was Barack Obama's mentor. Barack Obama started out as a community organizer. And Cloud-Piven strategy was employed to overwhelm the welfare system. It had nothing to do with helping poor people, believe me. It was all about jamming the system so that wealth could be redistributed and everybody would become equal. You know, they would have efforts. There was different groups that would basically crowd into welfare offices. They'd bring women, they'd bring African-American women in particular, you know, very sympathetic people, and they would crowd them into the office demanding welfare. And then they'd call the media, which would very happily come down and cover this, and the system would become jammed with requests to the point where the whole thing would implode. Well, this is the approach that Acorn used in various areas, but in the case I'm talking about, voting. They would overwhelm local clerks and precincts with false registrations, you know, registrations for Mickey Mouse or whatever. Meanwhile, there were people who advocated at higher levels for making it so easy to register that it would be impossible to stop fraud. A good example of that, frankly, is California. You know, Donald Trump said that one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton got 2.8 million more votes than him in the popular vote, and I love the way the left says 3 million, you know. They can't even tell the truth about a lie. But the reason is because California made it so easy to register to vote that you can do it online, that virtually anybody can get a ballot. Now, I personally did some research on this. I didn't go all the way through the website of the California Secretary of State and register to vote, because if I did that, I would be committing a felony and I could end up in jail, so I didn't do it. However, I took it through several prompts to the point just short of signing, which I didn't do. But what I discovered as I went through the Secretary of State's website is that you can get a registration without proving anything. You don't have to have a driver's license. You don't have a social security number. You don't even have to have a physical address. All you have to do is give a name, a city, and you have to check a box saying, on penalty of perjury, I am a citizen, or something to that effect. And you're registered. Now, anybody could do that. And by the way, the California system is really behind the times in terms of the website, much more behind than Massachusetts, in that they have no way of knowing if how many votes are registered on one laptop. I mean, you could register hundreds of votes from one laptop, right? At least in Massachusetts, you can't do that. And California is one of the most cyber-sophisticated states. It's the headquarters of Google and Microsoft and Facebook and all these other groups. And yet they're way behind. So really, anybody can register practically through the Secretary of State's office. And we know that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders used volunteers and maybe even paid staffers, I don't know, who were self-described illegal aliens, undocumented people, to go out and conduct voter drives. And they used as a piece of propaganda, or even as a piece of truth, which is beside the point, that you'd better register to vote and you'd better vote because Donald Trump is going to kick you out of the country if you don't. So that particular combination might indicate, you know, undocumented aliens going out and registering people, computers that you can register hundreds of people at one sitting, a system where you don't have to give your license, you don't have to give your social security number, you don't even have to give your address to register. Am I stretching it by saying that that is a recipe for voter fraud? I think not. Anyway, so that's going to be the subject of my article at Newsmax.com. Check out my books. They're available at Amazon or Amazon Kindle. Just put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, and you'll have it. Let's see. I'm trying to get some music here so I can sign out the show. And I want to thank everyone for listening this afternoon. I shall return, God willing, in 2 weeks on Thursday. Just trying to figure out how to sign out here. I'm so, like, inept at these things. How do I sign out? Here we have...
Hi, I'm Chuck.
Hi, Chuck. I'm Chuck. Do you know how to sign out, Chuck? I'll log off. There we go.
Yeah.
And there we go. Okay, so I've now logged off. How do I put on some music so we can send you on to the great and glorious show?
It's quite a Rivendell.
Yeah, we can click on Rivendell. This?
We don't want animation. Just click on the window.
This window?
It's hidden by this right now.
Okay. Click
and
this.
And add a song.
Oh, there we go.
There you go.